So tonight we're going to continue the Eightfold Path and squeeze the rest of the talks in this month in February so that we'll have it all wrapped up by the end of February before I leave in for March. And it will be about 25 talks, I believe. It's amazing, isn't it? 25 talks on the Four Noble Truths. Now divide that into. but it's actually a wonderful series from my point of view, because it's gotten me, every time I give a talk or give a series, it enriches my own way of seeing it. It deepens my understanding of it and provides a smooth continuity between all the different factions. And tonight we're going to bring forth a large component of our life in terms of wise livelihood. And if you think about it, it consumes about a third of our day and is a huge component of whether our lives are going to be spiritual or not, as to how we address the those 8 hours that we spend at the office or wherever it might be. And so tonight I'd like to explore that understanding of how to use that. See, I think we make a real mistake in leaning on the job to be spiritual and not us to be spiritual within the job. And I'd like to encourage just the opposite. It's very rare for a person to have integrated their work life into their family life, into their whole of their life. Very rare. It's very rare for people to be doing what they love to do. Very rare. Usually we're not doing what we love to do. And we feel it very compartmentalized, the work world very compartmentalized from the rest of our life. That's the norm. And so the one third that we spend at work doesn't feed the other two thirds that we spend living our life outside of work. In fact, it can be a deterrent from the full integration of that other two thirds. But if you look at it, oftentimes the person who is spending the minimum of 8 hours, and often it's much more than that, especially around here, spends more time with their peers on the job than they do with their family. And now that's a very interesting equation. In fact, a few years ago I had a Microsoft executive come to me who was dying and expressed the regret that he had and not spending more time with his family. Didn't regret working at Microsoft and showed just the opposite, much appreciation for it. But he did regret the time away from his family. And this was a young man. Begin to understand why it is that I had never heard anyone, and I've been with hundreds, perhaps thousands of people on the edge of their life, never say they wish they had worked more hours. Not one time. But often the opposite is very much spoken about. And so you begin to wonder why it is that it feels as if one is keeping us from the other. Of course, there's physical distance, but the heart, expression of the heart, because I don't think that we encourage a lot of heart in the work that we do. It's much more around the mental components of work and find ourselves very much in an intellectual display at work, for the most part. Not for everyone, of course. But even at times when I was in hospice care myself, I often found that, you could, after a number of similar cases, you could be with a person in rote routine and say all the right things and never meet them. And I'm talking about somebody who's dying, right? It's not callousness. It's just that's the way the mind loves to run itself. It loves to run itself on automatic, so it doesn't have to make genuine contact and feel the pain or the vulnerability of that contact. As one hospice worker told me, he said he has to wake up to his job every day, which is very, very true. Or we just go on automatic. We just go on the intellect. We just go on what we've always done in that particular job. Now, it's interesting because mostly we don't often choose our profession. I mean, we go to college and we have sort of an orientation of what we like to do. We get out of school, perhaps, and we apply. And then we get a job. But the job may not be in aligned with the original intentions of why we had our degree. And then once we're inside whatever that job may be, doors often open, and suddenly we're sliding across the corridors into different offices, advancing perhaps through that particular organization. And we're in a completely different job than we had ever thought or anticipated ourselves to be when we went through school. In fact, it's almost as if the profession chose us at this point, rather than we chose the profession. And why it is that we just moved across the corridor and into other offices and just let that unfold without asking very relevant questions at each phase of that unfolding, I don't quite know, except that I think that the societal values, what society tells us we should be getting out of the job, is in conflict with our spiritual values. And so we are often running on the societal values of self-importance, you know, of making an impact, of wanting to live our life really having people recognize that our sense of worth and what we've done, perhaps with status and money. But we never ask ourselves whether it is genuinely fulfilling or whether it's heart-connecting. Or whether this next rung up is going to take me from the very reasons that I joined the organization to begin with, which is what happened to me as a hospice worker. I was at the bedside for a number of years, loving the ongoing relationship of just going from one patient to another, and then a job opened up where I could get into management. Somehow I didn't question it. I just went into management. And I should have known better. And so then you find yourself, if I asked myself now why I did that, was because of some unaddressed needs to be more in control, or some of the psychological plays that come into one's life in terms of asserting power or authority or just wanting to be more influential, or all the things that society tells us is the right way to often move in relationship to our job. But what's very obvious is that you move away from your heart, or often you move away from your heart in making those decisions. So that in one point, instead of being at the bedside of the dying, I was making decisions, financial decisions, because once you get into management, then you didn't have to consider the welfare of not the patient so much, but also the organization that which feeds the patient, which serves the patient. So you make decisions about the priorities of giving the patient what he or she may need at the bedside, or keeping the organization healthy. You see? You see that? And those are often in conflict. Often in conflict. And you begin to think, my God, and many times I sat at my desk saying, I never wanted to do this. Never. How did I find myself in this? How did this happen? I just kind of grew into it. People thought I would be good at it. And I wasn't really. But you don't really, I never questioned it. It just kind of course, yeah, sure. You want to be the head of the social worker? Sure, I'll do that. You know, why? Why do I want to do that? Well, it's more money, right? Nevertheless, the spiritual values that we hold and the societal values are often in conflict because the, and so what originally interests us and had an enormous amount of passion on our job suddenly begins to deplete us because we're no longer in the midst of that passion, no longer in the midst of that interest. And what has happened is that, you know, something caught our eye and we moved off the center. You know, we flinched. And the side inducements of control, power, influence, status, whatever it might be, begins to be the reason that we're on the job rather than the reason, the initial reason, which was whatever it, the interest that was induced from that subject. And so it's almost like an accident that we find ourselves where we are. Because spiritual values, you see, don't hold that. It's very interesting. Let me just, many of you have been on retreat or volunteered or whatever. And you have a yogi job. A yogi job. Now the spiritual, you see, there's a dignity in that yogi job. You may be cleaning toilets or washing pots. But there's a deep sense of resonance in that yogi job that you're part of the whole, you're part of the whole sangha, that you're making the whole thing work, that there's dignity in whatever we do because all the different parts, the whole depends on all the synergy of the different parts. But when we are in an organization, we lose that perspective that we're feeding the whole. And it's often much more about feeding myself and trying to get the necessary individual needs met rather than looking upon it as a nobility in and of itself. Because many of us are in conflict with a society of the whole. We don't like to think of ourselves as feeding this thing because when we look out at what society is, we don't appreciate it necessarily, the way it's moving, its value system. We don't like to think of our job as feeding, but it is. It's part of the whole of the society as well. And so we get very spiritually purist, and we get very self-righteous in our because we bring our values, our spiritual values, into our organizational values, and the organization isn't living up to our spiritual values. It's using excessive energy when it's making me drive all over and wasting gas. It's burning trees or I don't know, you know, so we get this kind of self-righteousness. And then we get at odds with the organization. But if you look at society, society does excessively use energy. Our society does disproportionately use resources. And any job we take quite likely will have that theme because it feeds the general value system of the whole society. Now that's just a given. I can't think of very many jobs that don't have that as a component part of it. And you'll see, yes, we create such spiritual havoc with that. You see, the Buddha was interesting. The Buddha didn't nitpick like that. He talked about, I'm moving all over with my talk, so I'm... he said, when he was talking about wrong livelihood, he said, these five trades, O monk, ought not to be taken up by a lay follower. Trading with weapons. Trading in living beings. Slavery. Trading in meat. That's an interesting one. Trading in drugs or intoxicants. And trading in poisons. That was it. That's the list. And so each of us, each job we hold, quite likely has a detrimental side to it. Right? We're using energy, we're not replenishing in the same way, we're expending. I don't know. And you begin to see that you can't hold a job in this culture and bring forth your spiritual righteousness. I mean, you can, but you'll just be miserable in it. And you'll fight it all along the way. So there's a kind of nobility where you have to give yourself over. Okay, understand the value and limitation of what you're doing. And if the value holds the predominance, not the limitation, then we have to give ourselves over to that. Doesn't mean that you don't work economically or you don't work ecologically or you don't do but to hold ourselves to blame the job for our spiritual divisiveness. No, we can't really do that. We're a part of the society, and as much as you wouldn't like to be, you are. And we are all equally responsible in some way for the drift of the way it's going. And for our leadership. And we can blame it all we want, but we are also an intricate part of it. And that's a fact. And for us to take that and move it into our job and not let our job become the upsetting quality of our life, how it depletes me and how, all of the different ways that we're giving ourselves over to the very values that we seem to also have such inhibition and resistance to. Where's the nobility the nobility of just being fully there in our job, showing up for our work, not letting ourselves be divided and unresolved. There's an enormous field of possibility and potentiality at work that can heal many of the rifts, many of the divisive ways that we carry our lives. And for us to be able to take that on as a secondary job, our spiritual focus of being able to hold our work and within the work be able to hold the spiritual divisiveness that we bring to the work or to each other in inner relationships, on and on to our integrity, all of that. We need to show up for our work. We've chosen it. Let's show up for it. And outside of those five different categories, which I'm sure there aren't very many of us in the room that are doing those things, every job, as I said, is going to have some detrimental side to it. So it's just like a relationship. Every relationship has a detrimental side to it. And if you just focus in on that one area of that person, you miss the completeness of what you're doing or who you're relating to. And you can just keep looking at the pockmark that shouldn't be there. Instead of just embracing the whole and working very heartfelt towards that whole. That spirit of yogi job, I used to fight it when I was young in my spiritual practice, and they would give me a job. I just thought, I just thought it was just a cheap way of making me work for nothing. And I paid for the retreat, and here they're making me work too. I really resented it. It was interesting. The more I resented it, the harder the jobs became. And one time I was at a a 30-day retreat, and I was the sole pot washer for the lunch of 100 people, for 100 people on a 30-day retreat. And it would take me 2.5-3 hours to do all the pots. That was my job. And I was miserable that retreat. Miserable. Because that was the way I saw the whole of the retreat. People were getting, doing something to me and forcing me, and just, I'd been set up and, Doesn't that sound familiar? You see, I mean, the nobility or the wholeheartedness of working, you every moment you're wondering, what does life want for me in this moment? What is the appropriate response? What's the appropriate action? What's the appropriate interrelationship here? What is life wanting from me in this moment? And you can see it, you can feel it inside of us. We each can feel it. So work becomes an extension of wise action. It becomes an extension of the whole embodiment of wise view and wise intention. It's not just about what we do, it's about everything that goes on all day long as we're doing it. And the interaction. It's not just about the product, that whatever the organization, the product of the organization, be it a service project or whatever it might be. And it has nothing to do with whether it's a service project or not. You can have wise livelihood and, you know, be a manual laborer very successfully and work by yourself, or be an astronomer and just stare out a telescope. If we reframe this away from whether it's spiritual in where its direction, if we reframe it to whether it is enlivening for us, whether it enlivens us. If you ask that question, if we ask that question as the day unfolds, we will then find the way to interface with our work that creates the excitement of the initial motivation for why we got in that work to begin with. Something quite likely was enlivening about that subject when we first took it on, or when we first applied for that. And to rediscover, not with some spiritual judgment, but with aliveness itself. Where is there aliveness in here? How can I become more alive? And often it's not in necessarily the main point and focus of the work. It's in the interactions throughout the day. It's in thinking of yourself as a part of the whole and how to integrate into the whole organization to help it move forward. So wise view and wise intention is available within any job, not just within a spiritual job, not just within service work, but within any job. We can come alive. If that's our intentionality, which, as we have spoken about with the other areas of the Eightfold Path, it is. It's just that. And if we find ourselves bored with what we do, which most people do at some point, just as you find yourself bored with sitting or with walking or with any other routine task, that says often much more about us than it does about the job. And can we see it anew? Are we strong enough to be able to hold the boredom so it doesn't define our relationship to work? And to be able to see through that so that we can then still have a spontaneous action or interaction with what's there. and a creative action. Because that's really what we're looking for. We're looking for some form of creativity within our work. And it may not be in what the work actually is. It may be in the auxiliary components of the work that we find the creativity. See, stop looking at the direction the work is going for a sense of fulfillment. And start bringing our aliveness to the small incidences throughout the day in which we can creatively respond to one another. But we so easily fall into a kind of despair that's I've spoken about many times, and it's many disguises of inadequacy or whatever it is, or just feeling that what's really intoned in us, the societal values of self-importance, just isn't being fulfilled on this job. And there can be a kind of despair that we grow in the work, that we're not going to be fulfilled, we're not going to be acknowledged, we're not going to be received as unique, as special, as critically important. That's where we need to focus. Asking that, the truth of those statements, of the societal statements, any more than on a yogi job, you know, to clean the toilets. Well, this isn't really bringing the best outside of me out. This isn't where I'm really, my potential lies hidden. I should be, you know, explaining how everyone else should be working. Be a manager of the workers. That would be my real potential. Nonsense. Nonsense. I used to seek out cleaning the toilets, and that's why I bring it up. Because I couldn't think of anything that would get me down on my knees and within the dirt like that. In fact, I still clean the toilets at our house. I do it better than she does. And how often money and social status take over in terms of work, doesn't it? It's interesting, the Buddha said this. He was talking to one of his lay disciples, and he said, "A householder, knowing his income and expenses, leads a balanced life, neither extravagant nor miserly, that thus his income will stand in excess of his expenses, but not his expenses in excess of his income." So he's not suggesting that we all go out and become homeless. He says, just look at this thing and be reasonable about it. Have a balanced life. Know what your expenses are, know what your income, and have more income than you have expenses. It amazes me how there is no top level of income in which somebody is satisfied. It just amazes me, as if you could spend. What are you going to spend it on? And yet that sense of needing more is there. Have you seen the CEO's salaries? What are you going to have more food? I mean, there's nothing you couldn't do with the amount of money you have, and yet the need to have more. It's the need to have more. And there's no end to that. And to actually begin to say, you know, this has nothing to do with the amount of income I have. It has to do with this eternal neediness I have. And so let me look at my expenses, let me look at my income. And you'll find that the level of your happiness is directly related to your simplicity, not to your extravagance. I mean, in this day and age, with all the beepers and pagers and everything going off, you know, we're always one call away from our self-importance. Somebody wants me. Somebody needs me. And we've lost a kind of relationship of standard of relationship somehow, of interconnectedness that these utensils, technological utensils, don't really hold. And our identity with our work is so strong. You know, it's so important for us to have a job in which, when we speak about our job, we're not embarrassed by what we say we do. In fact, one of the first questions we ask somebody when we get to know them is, what do you do? What work do you do? We even ask children, what are you going to be when you grow up? You see, I mean, what that implies to the child is that you're nothing until you grow up, until you have a functional way to produce something. Then I'll remember what you're about. See, these are all, we have to stand up to these societal practices, this madness. And remember cleaning the toilet here. Do we compromise our heart for status and money? Because they will compromise. That's how you can find yourself crossing the corridors and moving into higher and larger rooms within the office. And somehow something vague that used to mean so much, that holds your aliveness, is turned away from, and you're embracing some other societal value rather than the one that your heart really feeds on. I have a friend who is a petroleum engineer. He works for an oil company and he's an engineer. He finds new oil deposits. He's been a student of mine since I started teaching. And I can almost every year we have the same conversation about wise livelihood with him. So I'm working for the oil companies and but he enjoys what he does. He enjoys looking, you know, he keeps calling it plundering, you know, like pillaging. It's not. He's just looking for mineral deposits, mineral sources, resources. Are you alive in what you do? And can you find, if you say no, can you recover that aliveness? Can we brush off our relationship with it again? Can I recover my interest? You know, this next part of it, I almost left out of this talk because I thought this is such a luxury to even ask these questions. You know, when most of the world's population will do anything to work so that they can receive enough just to have bread in their mouth, for us to pander ourselves with questions of luxury about whether the work is really good, and is it good for me? Is it really fulfilling to me? when I was watching a show of people work in the diamond mines of South Africa at age 12, 13 years old, just to feed their families. What a luxury, you know, for us to ask those questions. If it's congruent with our principles, that's a luxurious question to ask. But nevertheless, we have the affluence to be able to ask those questions. And not all jobs necessarily can you convert or change to something that actually feeds us. Some actually deplete us, and there's no other way to rearrange ourselves so that it does anything else. I know that from a personal job. When I got out of college, I was a substitute teacher in a downtown urban city for junior high kids, and it was out of control. The only thing I could do as a substitute teacher was to stand in front of the door and keep them in the room. That was my lesson for the day. That's absolutely true. And they were just bedlam. And I would walk out of that classroom and I just was absolutely depleted. No, I did nothing. Didn't say anything, taught them nothing. Just kept them from going into the hall. And I thought, I can't do this. And yet I needed the money in order to go to graduate school. I needed to have something that I could work and like on days that I wanted to, because other days I was going to school. And so that was the only job that worked for me to be able to do. And yet I knew that I was deeply unfulfilled. So there are jobs that we get into which are just depleting. And for us to really look at that sincerely, because if you're depleted, you don't have time for the other two-thirds of our life, because we don't have the resources to maintain a genuine composure in that one-third. Then it's really look at that and see whether there's somewhere else that you can move over to, another job you can take. Not just to stay in it because you know it or because it's familiar to you. And there are times when you just can't maintain that work. Fair enough. But most people bring their own mind to the job and defeat the job with their mind rather than the vice versa. Now that we can change. But we have to wake up. We have to be willing to show up, to actually bring the same aliveness in those 8 hours a day that we do when we're on the cushion. This is not just something we're trying to do to get money to feed the rest of our life so that we can. It's an opportunity. And those opportunities exist within that 8 hours as they do equally within the other 16. And not to develop this kind of routine relationship with our work so that we don't see it except from the history of our problems with it, and so that it's like an old relationship, you know. It's like, oh God, I don't really want to be in this relationship, but I have to be. All right, another day. We get that feeling. How can we live like that? There's no dharma in there. There's no life to that. And for most of us, we can wake up in it. We can refresh ourselves if we just find our way back to what it is that pulled us into that kind of work to begin with. And dust it off. And look at it critically. And start asking questions that allow us to start showing up. Like, how am I relating to this moment? How have I compromised my passion You see, you really see that when you're with the boss, when you're not saying what you really think, when you sort of tuck yourself in, when you become too much of a company person, when you don't allow the authenticity to grow, which is hard, because every one of those have a risk associated with them. Where do we compromise our integrity? That's where we'll feel the despair, our spiritual despair. Again, in hospice care, because the hospice that I was working for here in Seattle had a home care component, and the hospice was making money and the home care was losing it, the administrator, who was my boss, was taking the money from the hospice and helping to support the home care, which to me was like robbing the dying. I mean, it's just taking money that I could be using to serve the dying and bringing it to home care, which I guess from an organizational standpoint was, but it didn't fit my integrity. And I just went to him and I let it be known, you know, that I needed him to look at this in a different way. Just a bit. I had to do that. So it's not to stay sort of tucked in, you know, and never speaking out of turn or just kind of rolling with the punches. It's developing that authenticity, and often there's a risk there associated with it, is whether you'll even keep your job. But what job is worth keeping if you can't be authentic within it? And that authenticity doesn't have to be something elaborate or extravagant. It can be just in how we relate to those around us. Be careful of your spiritual purity and poo-pooing jobs that do this or that. It's like somebody who just refuses to eat meat. I'm not going to eat meat. You're sitting at a dinner table and the guest is giving you the best they have and they happen not to know that you're a vegetarian and they serve meat. Eat the meat. Don't make such a big thing of it. The Buddha did. So do monks. To this day they eat meat. If they're given meat that wasn't killed specifically for them, they are then required to eat what is given to them. And the most important question, are we using our job to become alive? Or just a deadness? And where can I infuse my interest, my passion, my curiosity? Where can I get back? Can there something in the job that I can find and recover? That which holds heart. Is there some way? Maybe I can ask for a different project, or maybe I can elaborate on the project I already have to infuse some creativity into it. It's an 8-hour a day task. But spiritual living is a 24-hour a day task. And may we all be successful in that. Can we sit for a minute or two? Okay, we have a little bit of time for questions and comments. If anyone has them, I'd be happy to do my best. Yes.
So I consider myself sort of fortunate around that. The issue for me is, I'm maybe on the other side of this. the spectrum. It's not only an interest, it's that there is so much work.
Right.
And it's meaningful and
right.
All of this thing. But it adds such a level of stress
right.
to my life
right.
that I feel then it's taking me off center.
Right. So his statement was that it's not so much the kind of work he does or the level of interest or passion he has. He feels interested, very interested in the work he does. But rather it's the stress and the amount of work that's there that's taking him off center. And I think this is a component part. I was actually going to speak about it the week after next, which will be the second talk on this particular subject. But I'll just brush on it now. This sense of busyness, we really have to explore. Anywhere that you feel yourself off center is really a call for inquiry. We have to look at what we're getting by being off center. And that's a hard question to ask, especially when it's so obvious what the limitations are when you are being so busy, so active, and under such stress and anxiety. What is it that's actually, what is it that's being fed within that busyness? What is it that I like about it? It's an interesting question and one that should not be just set aside, but really explored, because it never slows down as long as that is unexamined. So I'm not going to give you too much of my response to it, but encourage you to really look into that particular facet. Itself. It was a long time when I discovered that the stress I carried in the job, thinking in terms of radical accountability, was due to my own self-pressure I was doing to myself. It was what I was forcing on myself. It was my expectation. And the reason that I took on as many tasks and didn't self-limit was because of that inward idealism I had about what I could do and didn't ever want to say no. And so when I examined the pain and what was driving that stress and what kept that work mounting, because the employer never, they never take you into consideration. At least I never saw my employer taking me into consideration. If I said I could do it or I never said no, I got the next task. And on and on and on it went. And finally I said, wait a second. No. Thinking that all hell would break loose. And he says, I'm glad to see that you're developing some sanity with your job. Remember radical accountability. It has a lot to say about our work. You know, whatever is happening, we would love to blame on the boss, you know, whatever. But it's always a product of our own self-disservice, what we're doing to ourselves, which creates the tension and the stress and the anxiety and the overload. Anyone else? Yes.
So what about the Buddhist perspective on like retirement and saving for old age?
That's part of it. She says, what about the Buddhist perspective on retirement and old age? I mean, that's not in the scriptures, but when he's talking about expenses and income, he means for your welfare. He means for your retirement. He means for your security in old age, right? For your health care. The dynamics that are at play at this particular time in life weren't there 2,500 years ago. I don't know how they did it. They had extended families that took care of you, I guess, or something. But in any case, it's not outside of what we need to do now. Retirement needs to be done. But how, you know, that, it's, see, the edge that's played is that fear never says we have enough. And that we have, you know, that's always the edge that we play. So that, no matter how much is in the closet and in the bank, it's never sufficient for what I want in retirement. And, you know, then you don't live to be 65 and retire. It's interesting how many times I've seen people set aside their retirement and never even live to make it to that. So it needs to be like everything else, within proportion. We don't know how we're going to live, but let's have enough if we can do it. Have enough to get by. Let's see if we can do it without all this anxiety and yet be, as the Buddha said, be aware of what your needs will be and what your expenses will be, and make sure that what you have will exceed what you will spend in retirement. So I don't think it's separate.